Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Friday, March the 29th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast. Later on in our program, we're going to feature a report from the United Nations Rapporteur for Palestine, whose findings support the lawsuit filed by the Republic of South Africa against the State of Israel, charging genocide for its war in Gaza. Before that, we review a rare archival audio file of a panel discussion on the threat of fascism. This was held in 1969 at the National Revolutionary Conference for United Front Against Fascism, held in Oakland, California, in July of 1969. The women represented in this segment are leaders of the Black Panther Party and other organizations active during the time period, during the 1960s and later during the 1970s. We are continuing our commemoration of International Women's History Month. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take our music interlude with the legendary Mama Africa, Miriam Makeba. This is a collection of songs and compositions from various aspects of her long, decades-long career. Some of the groups in which she performed with in South Africa prior to coming to the United States, such as the Skylarks and the Manhattan Brothers. Let's listen to this music. Who's that?
Humble. seagull in the morning. He comes flying on the wings of time. Stars will be falling, he'll be calling. Come to judgment, come live humble.
Live humble,
humble,
live humble.
Humble yourself, the bell's gonna roll. Well, live humble,
live humble,
humble,
live humble.
Humble yourself, the bell's gonna roll.
balala izinyembe bayalela omama emakhaya Balilela o baba ezansi emgodini.
Ayibusisi emakhaya, ngekhaya emakhaya.
Soon one morning. Comes a creeping in the room.
Well, brother, soon
one morning.
Morning.
Death comes a creeping in the room. Soon one morning.
Morning.
Death comes a creeping in the room. Crying, oh my Lord, oh my Lord, what shall I do, what shall I do? Well, you may call on your mother, your mama can do you no good.
Well, you may
man. fire is called.
Oh, sawubona Mary.
Mona Spooks.
Kawusondele ke ngiphathe kancinci.
Aw, uzawuphatha ni nje Spooks ngoba mina ngisisona isidudla.
Sweet, Here's a song that comes from Tanzania. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Ingekuwa wa maliwe, ingekuwa wa hatada. Nashindwa na mali sina we. Roho yangu comes from
Pondoland in the Eastern Cape. In the olden days, the young maiden often sang this song in praise of the young brave as they would get ready to go out into battle. It's a song of encouragement. We call it Cholingo. Yes. Kaiba. Cholingo.
Thank you.
Welcome back. And that was Mama Africa, Miriam Makeba, with a wide spectrum of her musical legacy from the 1950s to the 1970s and 80s. And Miriam Makeba from the South African region of the African continent, the Makeba began her professional career with the Cuban Brothers, a South African all-male close harmony group with whom she sang covers of popular American songs. Soon afterwards, at the age of 21, she joined a jazz group, the Manhattan Brothers, who sang a mixture of South African songs and pieces from popular African-American groups. Makeba was the only woman in the group. With the Manhattan Brothers, she recorded her first hit, La Cushine Ilanga, in 1953, and developed a national reputation as a musician. In 1956, she joined a new all-woman group called the Skylarks, singing a blend of jazz and traditional South African melodies. Formed by Gilliton Records, the group was also known as the Sunbeams. Makeba sang with the Skylarks when the Manhattan Brothers were traveling abroad. Later, she also traveled with the Manhattan Brothers. In the Skylarks, Makeba sang alongside Rhodesian-born musician, Zimbabwe-born musician now, Dorothy Masuka, whose music Makeba had followed along with that of Dolly Ratebe. Several of the Skylark pieces from this period became popular. The music historian Rob Allegom later described the group as, quote, real trendsetters with harmonizations that had never been heard before, unquote. Makeba received no royalties for her work with the Skylarks. While performing with the Manhattan Brothers in 1955, Makeba met Nelson Mandela, then a young lawyer. He later remembered the meeting and that he felt that the girl he met was going to be someone. With the Manhattan Brothers, Makeba recorded Lukushana Ilanga, written by Mackie Davishi. The song popularity prompted requests for an English version. And in 1956, Gallatone Records released Lovely Lies, Makeba's first solo success and first recording in English. However, the cultivated lyrics about a man looking for his beloved in jails and hospitals was replaced with the unrelated and innocuous line, "You tell such lovely lies with your two lovely eyes," in the English version. The piece became the first South African record to chart on the United States Billboard Top 100. In 1957, Makeba was featured on the cover of Drum magazine. In 1959, Makeba sang the lead female role in the Broadway-inspired South African jazz opera King Kong. Among those in the cast was the musician Hugh Masekela. The musical was performed to racially integrated audiences, raising her profile among white South Africans. Also in 1959, she had a short guest appearance in Come Back Africa, an anti-apartheid film produced and directed by American independent filmmaker Lionel Rogosin. Rogosin cast her after seeing her on stage in African jazz and variety show, on which Makeba was a performer for 18 months. The film blended elements of documentary and fiction and had to be filmed in secret as the government was expected to be hostile to it. Makeba appeared on stage and sang two songs. Her appearance lasted 4 minutes. Cameo made an enormous impression on viewers, and Rogosin organized a visa for her to attend the premiere of the film at the 24th Venice Film Festival in Italy, where the film won prestigious Critics' Choice Award. Makeba's presence has been described as crucial to the film, as an emblem of cosmopolitan black identity that also connected with working class black people due to the dialogue being in the Zulu language. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast, and March is International Women's History Month, and of course, Miriam Makeba, an African woman who made tremendous contributions to the culture, politics of the African people, not only in South Africa, not only in the African continent, but indeed throughout the entire globe. This is an African Journal. We're back with more of our program for this week. Yeah.
know. Everybody's talking everywhere you go. You're trying to give another man a helping hand. He will take your kindness for a week of sand. Never do to others what they do to you. Try to find another way to make it through. What I say is what I know. Try to get a favor going from door to door. You stop and pray. It's out of style. You get a step ahead. It takes 100 miles. An hour. What I say is what I know. Try to get a favor going from door to door. You stop and pray. You know that's out of style. Get a step ahead. It takes 100 miles. Now you're trying to give another man a helping hand. He will take your kindness for a week of sand. Never do to others what they do to you. You better do it to them before they do it to you. What you do and what you say has a lot to do in how you live today. What you want and what you make, everybody knows it's only what you take. Or now what you see and what you hear, when it comes around again, it's not gonna be the same thing. Because you're gonna say yes, and they're gonna say no. And then everybody's gonna start talking and talking and blah blah everywhere you go. And you know something? You try to give another man a helping hand. You know what he's gonna do? He's gonna take your kindness for a week of sand. You try to do for others what you'd like for them to do to you. Forget it. It's gonna be some other kind of thing. So you try to give another man, now listen, a helping hand. He will take your kindness. Never do to others what they do to you. I'm gonna try to do the best I can, baby, to talk it to you. You better try to give another man another kind of helping hand. Try to do the best you can for everyone.
Donna Hightower with the track entitled The World Today is a Mess. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. For Friday, March the 29th, 2024, we're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. March is International Women's History Month, and right now we're going to listen to a rare archival audio file from the National Revolutionary Conference on Forming a United Front Against Fascism. This conference was held in mid-July of 1969 in Oakland, California. Primarily designed to build a broad-based alliance against the repression being leveled against the Black Panther Party during 1969. Let's listen to this broadcast right now.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes our history out of the vault and onto the radio. On this edition of From the Vault, we celebrate Women's History Month by presenting a panel from the 1969 three-day Black Panther Party conference entitled Women Speak Out Against Fascism.
For too long, the victims of exploitation and repression and racism have been asked to pay the price to maintain a system which rewards and promotes the real criminals in society to positions of great wealth and power. Again, organize, organize, and resist. Power to the people.
In July of 1969, the Black Panther Party invited a broad coalition of groups to participate in a three-day conference called the United Front Against Fascism. They invited famed attorney William Kunstler, Oakland Mayor and future 13-term Congressman Ron Dellums, and other luminaries of the day. But what sets this conference apart from mainstream events of the time was the inclusion of people who worked every day to help end oppression in their community. So while conference attendees would hear the analysis of fascism from the likes of Ron Dellums,
racism becomes the convenient vehicle by which fascism may become an accomplished fact in this country.
They would also hear from relatively unknown speakers like Carol Thomas from the Southern Christian Education Fund.
Because of the economic and legal powerlessness of women, they have little or no control over their lives. Their sons, their brothers, and their husbands are disposed of by the ruling classes either as cannon fodder in war, in which these same People are asked to make total commitments and give their lives while the fascist capitalists reap profits.
Today we focus on the panel, Women Speak Out Against Fascism. The term fascism was never clearly defined in this panel discussion in the same way, say, Naomi Wolf, for example, outlined 10 easy steps to change a democratic nation into a fascist state. But this was an opportunity for women, from different perspectives, to illuminate areas in our society where inequalities ran along class, gender, and oftentimes racial lines. Event organizers invited Marlene Dixon, a PhD of sociology from UCLA, as the keynote speaker, but she deferred a majority of her time to the women who had first-person experience with injustice in their community. Keep in mind that this panel was recorded in 1969, at a time when the FBI's COINTELPRO program was infiltrating and disrupting groups like the Black Panther Party, who were providing valuable services such as breakfast programs, health services, and educational classes to the underserved community. We begin with Black Panther chairwoman Elaine Brown reading a letter written by recently imprisoned Black Panther leader Erica Huggins, now a professor of women's studies at the California State University, East Bay.
I'll waste very few words of my own because Erica said just about anything there is to say regarding the fascist treatment not only of herself but of all, the political prisoners. This was written in Niantic Prison on July 8th of this year. Long live the United Front Against Fascism, down with the reactionaries of all kinds. It is impossible to say what I feel now. It would take too long and the state doesn't offer enough paper. But because none of us can be with you, I will try. I can envision as I write the people that will hear this. I can see their faces. I can feel their warmth, the warmth that comrades often have for each other. I can also see the faces of some who always appear among the people, the worried, empty, brutal faces of the agents of fascism. Worried because they know that people, poor people, oppressed people, gather together but for one reason, to analyze the conditions of their oppression and wipe it out. Empty, because they have no feeling for the masses of people, for the souls of the revolutionaries we have lost, for the starving babies of this country and the world. And brutal, because they will fight to the last ditch to destroy the revolutionary fervor of the people. They all continue to run back, oinking to the oppressors about the people's plans to rise up. They fail, however, to realize that the masses have boundless creative power. And no matter how they kick ass, beat us, kill us, or jail us, the people will carry on. I see the faces of change. I hope that many minds are open to what is happening. I know that many ears have been listening to the foul utterances America spits out at the world. We have listened too long, and the bitch, her mouth reeking of death, says, "We have thoroughly oppressed our people at home. We are succeeding at keeping Vietnam in a state of decay. We are trampling on Africa. We are destroying South America, making bigger and better alliances with Russia. We have only to wait for Mao to die, and we will be the world power, and then we will place our murder on the moon." America is plotting universal imperialism. It will be the same everywhere. First Coca-Cola, then Oscar Mayer Wieners, and then the troops. That's right on, Erica. The people cannot take this. We cannot allow fascist fanatics to continue to deprive us of our human rights. We must organize and form an everlasting united front against capitalism, against imperialism, against class distinctions, against racism, against fascism. We cannot allow concessions from the federal government for the continual harassment and unwarranted brutality of the people. We cannot allow our children, be they black, Mexican, Indian, Japanese, Chinese, or white, to be miseducated and degraded in America's degenerate school system. We cannot allow any more lynchings, bombing, and racial ignorance down south or up south. We cannot allow unions any longer to drive the working class. The working class must drive the unions. Our fight must be endless to organize the workers of this country, to overhaul and change every assembly line and every factory. We cannot allow medical services in our communities to remain inadequate. We need more hospitals, more doctors, more nurses, and less insistence on medicinal genocide or birth control. We cannot allow the reformists to clean up the surface while the inner structure rots. We need a revolution. All of our thoughts, each of our actions should lead us to one goal, the emptying of the that fills the bowels of this country. We can no longer allow the senselessness of anarchy and arbitrary destruction. We need no more impulsive, opportunistic movements, groups, or political parties that endure on socialistic rhetoric. We need socialism in practice.
Right on.
But in times of difficulty, we cannot lose sight of our achievements. We must see the bright future for the people and pick up our courage. We realize that there are people that support us and that however long we remain here, we serve as a catalytic agent to move the people forward. We only ask that you realize who your real friends and your real enemies are. We must draw a clear line of demarcation between the oppressors and the oppressed, between the imperialists and the internationalists, between the pigs and the people. Who sits next to you? All power to the oppressed people. Long live the people's revolutionary struggle. Long live the Minister of Defense. Free all political prisoners. It's Erica Huggins. All power to the people.
That was Black Panther Chairwoman Elaine Brown from 1969 reading a letter written by recently imprisoned Black Panther leader Erica Huggins. Erica was arrested with Black Panther founder Bobby Seale on conspiracy charges, which were dropped 2 years after her arrest. Here is Women Speak Out Against Fascism moderator and Black Panther Party official Marie W. Johnson to introduce each guest.
Sisters and brothers, I greet you with a sisterly love on behalf of us here on the panel. I hope you didn't come here hoping that we are going to entertain you because we just don't have the time. The people who will be speaking on this panel has not been chosen because of their revolutionary rhetorics. They were chosen because of their correct practice. I'd like to introduce you, starting with this beautiful sister to my left. She is Sister Carol Thomas, who is representing SCIF. Seated next to her is another beautiful sister, Sister Penny Nakatsu. She'll be talking to us about the problems of Asian people. We had hoped the native sister from America would have been with us. If Sister Deanne DeRyon is in the audience, we would love to have her among us. We have another sister who was detained because of delay of plane and is on the way at this very moment. So it doesn't matter the time, but how well you utilize it. And after all, like, we should really be out there with the masses. Continue with the introduction. On my right here, a beautiful sister called Sister Evelyn Harris. She'll be speaking about the problems of the poorest of the poor, the recipients, versus fascism. Next to her is seated another sister that's righteous. She's armed with correct theory and practice. None other than our own sister, Roberta Alexander. Seated next to Sister Roberta is another beautiful sister whom you'll get to know as well as I have. Her name, Sister Carol Henry. I'm Marie Johnson. Without much ado, I'd like to, first of all, set the tone to let you know that since we are equipped with correct ideology and correct practice, we know that fascism is terror, fascism is genocide, It is the most vicious child of dying imperialism. It is most important for women to be able to recognize fascism for exactly what it is. Every day, we are being used as tools by the avaricious businessman to perpetrate fascism upon all of us, as well as the exploitation of people of foreign lands. This panel hopes to arouse a sense of urgency with purpose among women. We got no time for rhetoric. There's too much to be done. We must get it together. Heretofore, women had been thought of as merely being content to remain in a prone position. Well, things ain't what they used to be, and they never will be. Fascism is being escalated upon all the people. We do not wish to separate ourselves as a separate entity. We came from the people. And by our deeds, by our correct actions, for the people, we hope to become that other half, not only of men, but of the masses of our people. It is up to every woman to join their sisters and brothers who are already in the struggle for survival. Survival. Women must acquire correct thoughts and perform correct daily actions. Daily deeds in a correct manner will liberate the minds of the women. There is no need to demand liberation. Get it together. Get the correct ideology. Put it into correct practice. And you'll be recognized by what you do, not just for the sake of being a woman, because we are of the people. We must not wait for fascism to vamp on us personally. An injury to one is an injury to all. You better believe it. Fascism is like a contagious disease. It terrorizes, and quite often it kills us. Remember a little sister from Nebraska? She was only 14 years old. Then we also have, facing a long prison sentence, Sister Erica Huggins. Brutality, fascism, she really knew it. She went through the same thing and is going through the same thing that Sister Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. Along with Sister Huggins, we mustn't forget our brothers, New York 21. We never forget Brother Linscomb, Brother James Rector, Brother George Basket, our own Brother Bobby Hutton, Bunchy Carter, and the late Brother Huggins of Sister Huggins. I have seen the mothers and the sisters. I have felt their pain. I have seen the young men coming from Vietnam limbless. They relate to us. So I would ask the audience, don't dig on time, but dig on good deeds. So before I take up much more of your time, the sisters here have much more than I could ever say. I'd like to first present Sister Roberta. Please come.
Right on. I'd like to start off by saying, brothers and sisters, that there is a struggle going on right now. Our topic up here today is to talk about women versus fascism, the role of women in the movement. There was some commotion here, and I'd like to address myself briefly to that commotion. I think it's significant. First of all, there's a struggle now going on in the Black Panther Party. A lot of people around the country are confused about what's happening now in the Black Panther Party, around the woman question, around the role of women in the Black Panther Party, This confusion has been created and added to with the demagogy of the bourgeoisie, with their Larry Powells and their McClellan committees. They're adding to the confusion of the people, and the Black Panther Party now wants to stand up forward before all of you and explain a little bit of what's happening. We talk about divisions among the people and how the ruling class uses those divisions to weaken the people and to weaken the people's struggles. We are now faced with a rising tide of fascism in this country, and the people have to be united in order to fight this tide. Huey P. Newton says, as the brother earlier said tonight, that we have to limit our bickering as much as possible between the movement and make our concentration upon the enemy. This is correct. And we must recognize the enemy when we see it. This is also very important, because if we don't know what the enemy is, then we're in bad shape. Now, on the question of male chauvinism, on the question of male supremacy, this is a true problem in our society and reflects capitalist society, period. Women are placed in a particular role and they're expected to stay in that role. We have problems in the party. That's true, because we are part of a society, and if we were to say we didn't have no problems, we'd be lying to the people. We're not going to lie to the people. In order for the people to understand the question, we'll tell the truth. For the last several months in our party, there have been struggles over this question. And the struggles have gone through the whole gamut of possible, you know, problems. They've gone through women leadership, women being able to be armed, defend themselves as well as the brothers, whether or not the women do all the typing, or whether or not they also take part in the armed self-defense and the running of the offices and not just behind the typewriters. And it even goes down to the sexual levels, you know, whether or not the women are supposed to do so-and-so for the cause of the revolution, et cetera. And there have been a hell of a lot of distortions about the party's position on precisely this point. There's been a lot of struggle in the party, and at times this struggle has become so oppressive that we think more. We have thought more. This has been corrected. We think more about the contradictions between the women and the men in the party, between the sisters and the brothers, than we do about the pigs. Now, there is a problem there, because that cannot be allowed. The pigs are out to murder us. The sisters and the brothers are class sisters and brothers. The sisters and brothers in a struggle. And the party has addressed itself to this problem and is now being resolved, and it is being resolved correctly. It's being resolved through an intense struggle among the party. The women, as Eldridge Cleaver said, are our other half. They're not our weaker half. They're not our stronger half. But they are our other half. Right on. All power to the people. Power to the people.
That was Black Panther member Roberta Alexander from the 1969 panel, Women Speak Out Against Fascism.
Being a woman, I have to correct myself. We got a beautiful sister sitting up on that end that flew in and got in here about an hour and a half ago from Los Angeles. Many of you are familiar with her. Her name is Sister Marlene Dixon from Los Angeles. So we'll follow the program in order. The next sister will be Sister Carol Henry.
Greetings, revolutionaries, brothers and sisters, all oppressed people. Yes, I said brothers and sisters, men and women. That sounds quite different from the animalistic terms that we often use to one another. Bitch, slut, cow, chick, nanny goat, and or oftentimes broad hole for those of you whose vocabulary have advanced to that complexity of decadence. I want to talk to you, and I only have limited time. And I don't want any more provocateurs standing up and running that kind of garbage. The acceptance of these crude terms, not only by the chauvinistic man, but by the woman herself, is a clear indication that respect and objective estimation of one's character is lost. Lost in an avalanche of insecurities and subjective, egotistical dispositions. Women, yeah, all you women, those of you who even shouted out, we are alienated from the word go. We have been alienated from basic humane relationships, humanitarian contact. We have been alienated from the other half, men. We have been alienated from our children, from ourselves. We have been separated by the tools of this fascist government, the bloody tools that have categorized us and deprived us socially, politically, and economically, and these are the same bloody tools that oppress us racially. Women, and especially white women who know so little of their oppression, women have been exploited mentally and physically by the color of their skin and the shape of their breasts. All I saw when I was a little girl was rosy cheek, straight-haired, white-skinned, blue-eyed baby dolls and sex-symbolized commercials. And from infancy, this creating inside of me whitewash criterions, making me feel that if you're white, you're right, and if you're black, get back. This feeling of inferiority is just one aspect to alienation. And the other aspect is superiority. Both of these manifestations of struggle align with the contradictions between the oppressed and the oppressors. In a fascist society, these contradictions are expressed through racial antagonism. Among the demented minds of racist women, the struggle is in competition against other women for castrated. Friends, and women in particular, in unison, we must let our battle cry be heard. We will no longer tolerate the arrogance, separatism, and magnanimous distortions arising from any kind of discrimination. We will no longer tolerate fascist tactics to attain finance capital through the blood, sweat, and tears of the people. The pig uses any means necessary to exploit, dehumanize, separate, and conquer. Down with the pig, fascist pig oppressor. Long live the people's liberation struggle. Long live Huey P. Newton and Eldridge Cleaver. All power to the people. Dare to struggle, dare to win. All power to the people. To the people. Right on.
Wow. Continuing on in the order, I wish now to introduce you to our sister, Penny Nakasu.
On the question of male supremacy and male chauvinism, as an Asian woman, I can speak well and long. I can speak well and long of the heroic women who have died combating racism and imperialism. I could speak of women like Iva Toguri Dakino, who spent 16 years in an American racist prison for a crime for which she had no part in. I could speak of a sister who died in the 1950s struggles in Tokyo, died in the struggle against the re-ratification of the United States-Japan Security Pact. And I could speak well and long of the heroic struggles of our courageous Vietnamese sisters, whose example I hope all women can well follow and learn from. But I will not. What I came here to speak of today is a story that many of you may not know of, may have forgotten, may not remember. The story begins in 1942. Many of the elements of the story are duplicated here today and now in the year 1969. The dates 1942, 1950, 1969, taken together as a sum total, equate American fascism today. In case many of you have not caught on to what I'm referring to, I'm speaking of the incarceration of more than 110,000 people, human beings, for the crime of having yellow faces, of having Asian names in World War II. The story goes like this. There was no law. There was no 1950 McCarran Internal Security Act at that time to put my people, our people, into the what was then euphemistically termed relocation camps. There were 10 of those camps. I will not call them relocation camps. I will not call them detention camps. I will call them the concentration camps that they were and are and still exist today. I come from a generation of children born in concentration camps. Many of these places you will find no longer exist on the map. They were born in places with names like Manzanar, Tule Lake, Topaz, Roer, and on and on. In 1942, a presidential mandate issued by President Roosevelt empowered the racist military under the leadership of General DeWitt to incarcerate 110,000 people, more than two-thirds of whom were American citizens. Many of these people remained in these concentration camps for the duration of the war. All of them received between 24 and 48-hour notice to report to the nearest military authority, to report their belongings, to dispose of their beloved possessions within the span of 24 and 48 hours. How generous, how magnanimous our government was, how magnanimous our government will be when it calls on us to report. But when it calls on us, we will not be sitting in our homes talking. We will be prepared to act. We will be prepared to move. The lesson that I hope we can learn from 1942 is not to wait until we have positive irrevocable proof of the racism and the all-encompassing determination of our monopolistic, capitalistic system to suppress all movements, all peoples who will work for social change, who will work for liberation, who will work for division of fascism and imperialism. Thank you. Power to the people! Power to the people!
Tell me that the sun belongs to you and should surround you. If when I turn to look, I see they've snatched the sun from all around you.
You are listening to Women Speak Out Against Fascism, a Black Panther Party conference held in 1969 on From the Vault for Women's History Month. For more information or to get a copy of this program or the other programs in our series, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. You can research our collection at pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to our program.
You were about liberty because you've been denied. Well, I think that you're mistaken, or then you must have lied. Cause you do not act like those who care. You've never even fought for the liberty that you claim to lack, or have you never fought to be?
I told you, the people that were on this panel not only work at the stuff, they have the experience, they live it. From the Southern Christian Educational Fund, I'd like to introduce to you Sister Carol Thomas, who'll be talking about the women and some of her experiences.
Good evening, brothers and sisters in struggle. Because of the economic and legal powerlessness of women, they have little or no control over their lives. They have little or no control over their children or what happens to them. Their sons, their brothers, and their husbands are disposed of by the ruling classes either as cannon fodder in war, in which these same people are asked to make total commitments and give their lives, while the fascist capitalists reap profits. Or they see their sons, their husbands, as workers in an industrial machine, which is not for the welfare of the workers, but for the profit again of the fascist capitalists. Mostly, what I want to talk about is some of the experiences that I had when we women in Gainesville, Florida, came together around certain issues. First of all, in the summer of 1967, the welfare mothers, the mothers on welfare, many of them organized into a welfare rights union. They went to the welfare department and demanded the necessities of life. They were only getting 66% of what was supposed to be basic needs. The pigs came. That was their response. We went back 2 weeks later after having presented our needs. Again, the pigs came. The women then took their requests to the county commission in Gainesville, and the reaction to that was to have the police come out and pick me up as an agitator and warn me that these women, if they continued to go to the county commission and agitate in the way they were doing for the necessities of life for their children, we're going to start a riot. I don't think we quite realized our power at that time. We happened to win a few concessions, like, you know, a food stamp plan or a commodity distribution program, but the power still remained with the pigs. Later, well, for several years, I had heard women had come to me out of the city jail and said they were being sexually molested by jailers in there. I took this information on their behalf very naively to the police department, thinking they were going to do something about it. I then took it to, again, very naively to a human relations commission, and they expressed the proper horror, and it was all covered up. None of the women that brought me these stories were willing to verify any of this in writing for fear of reprisals by people in the power structure whom the pigs represented. In 1967, we had some beautiful sisters come out of that jail, mad as hell. They were getting tuned into who they were, both racially and as women, and the power that they could command. We wrote up an affidavit, which a brother, Jack Dawkins, then read to the city commission after the women had organized and gotten their sisters to the city commission, and many of the brothers also. Jack Dawkins read the affidavit, and the immediate reaction was to cite him for contempt before the city commission. Failing this, they called for a grand jury investigation of practices into the city jail, where there were no matrons, and where women had almost died, several of them had almost died having miscarriages when the jailers didn't feel like walking up and attending to them. Well, we got the people there. The grand jury investigation was called for. The women came to the grand jury investigation, and they tried to testify. Instead of allowing the truth to come out, their relationships with various organizers in the community was pried into. Dawkins and I had written a paper analyzing what we expected to happen. In other words, nothing. No action. There was going to be a big whitewash. Well, to show you the way the pigs work, the state's attorney Xeroxed a copy of the paper and took it into the courtroom and said that we had taken it in. And he arrested us for contempt of court. We spent four months and six months in jail. The conviction has just been recently overturned. But while we were in jail, we did a bit of organizing. The men organized the men's cell block. The women organized the women's cell block. And we found we had such tremendous strength in the motto, one for all and all for one. And every confrontation we had, that's the way we carried it out. We got piddly little things like, you know, maybe heat when it was freezing. We got a change in diet, a little less starch. We had to practically make a riot in the jail to get sick prisoners to the hospital, which we did. The very threat of our organizing made the jailers adhere to the law. The juveniles were to be kept separately from the adults. But again, well, also, before this was over, prisoners with problems were sending them to the women's cell blocks. And we sort of changed the policy about how trustees were made and this kind of thing. And before it was over, there was a big riot in the jail, and nobody knew why. It seemed that we were not allowed to really solve anything ourselves. It was all doled out to us. Piecemeal, tokenism. And when we got out of jail, all of us that had undergone this experience realized that this was the same way it was on the outside. In fact, it didn't really make any difference whether you were in jail or out. The bars were the same. All right. We were out of jail and the women stuck together. During the time we were in jail, a number of firebombs got thrown in protest. They tried to blame it on black people, the people who had for so long suffered the indignities and the oppression and the exploitation by the white power structure. The only thing they could think to do was to arrest the people who were most militantly protesting the situation in Gainesville at the time, which they did. The women organized and harassed the hell out of the pigs. They had student help. A number of fire alarms got pulled. A number of phone calls were made in which the pigs just, you know, well, they couldn't use their phones anymore because the lines got all tied up. The analysis was that since one of the students had gone to Cuba, that he had brought back Cuban sabotage techniques and were applying them against Gainesville power structure. And they predicted they were going to have a long, hot summer that summer. And they did. You know, it's funny how they always know they're going to have one. They plan it. Well, the subject of my talk was supposed to be how to control the police in the community. I don't think you can control them. It's part of a larger question. As to how the power is going to be distributed. Are we going to let the pigs in the Pentagon send our men to Vietnam? Or are we going to organize and educate our sisters and engage in political struggles and resist? Or are we going to let stand by helplessly and cooperate in the repressive powers that are in the communities in our lives? No, we can't gain control in the present framework. We can only organize to resist the authority of the police and the courts. The courts, which are the bulwark for the fascist exploiters. For too long, the victims of exploitation and repression and racism have been asked to pay the price to maintain a system which rewards and promotes the real criminals in society to positions of great wealth and power. Again, organize, organize, and resist. Power to the people.
Thank you, sister. We have a very limited time, not because of chauvinism, but because of fascism. They want to put the lights out on them. Well, we can wrap in the dark. We've been in the dark, but we're coming out in the light, baby. This time, without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you from Welfare Rights Association here in Oakland, Sister Evelyn. Sister Evelyn Harris.
Greetings, brothers and sisters. I'm here on behalf of you, my brothers and sisters. I'm here to speak to you in behalf of the poor people, which is welfare recipients. I want to talk to you about some of the experience as well as education I've had. I am the chairman of the Welfare Rights Organization. And our purpose is to help the recipient to gain their pride and be as independent as anyone else. I have had the experience of working with the head of the welfare department, with private attorneys, legal aid, the district attorney, the probation office, and etc. You'd be surprised of the little knowledge that they know, especially the board of supervisors and the welfare commissioners. These are people that sit and make a budget for individuals to live on. For instance, I would take the budget for four, a family of four. Everyone talk about the taxpayers, the tax, their money coming out of their check. You'd be surprised what little money that a family receives to live on. And the DA, they sit there, deprive the mother of her personal problem, to expose her, to make her shame. But I want to let you know, if any of you in here that have problems, that is on welfare, there is no shame. You have a right to that money as well as the head of the department or the social worker. First of all, we are asking that we have qualified social worker which can be replaced by recipients. Everyone that is on welfare is not ignorant. They have the knowledge to computer budget. They have the knowledge to interview people. And this is what we are trying to get over, that we, welfare recipients, sit on the board of supervisors, help compute the budget. Welfare recipients sit on the commissioners and help make the laws. Welfare recipients can live a decent life and be just as proud as the next working man. Also, I would like to speak briefly that the problems, I can go on and go on, but the time is limited. That we're having problem with the school, well, the children in the school is branded because they are on welfare. The meal tickets that they receive, you'd be surprised at the food that they eat. And many of the children don't eat the food because it's not fitting. This is why that I will fight until I drop. Because no one else, I can challenge anybody in that welfare building, and I can do just as much as anybody else can do concerning the budget. Can no one live on, a mother of four can live on a budget of $221. There's PG&E to come out of there and your utility. That mother and one of those children are not being taken care of. This is the problem that we are faced with. And when they buy food or clothing, they pay tax on that. Because they are welfare recipients, they don't get nothing free. So they are taxpayers just like you or I. Anybody that works, they are taxpayers. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, sisters and brothers, while I can still read, the light's on, our last speaker is none other than Sister Merlene Dixon, Doctor of Sociology, UCLA.
We're short on time. And I don't want to ego trip, but it's true that I have a gift for being stubborn, which the University of Chicago had occasion to discover. We which is not unrelated to a talent for unpopularity either. And I can't make the little talk that I was going to give tonight without saying something about what happened tonight. And I think that it's important for people to understand that white women learned to be bitter and to be skeptical, and they have learned that from white radical male-dominated organizations. So tonight, I know that the majority of women moved not as provocateurs and not in bad faith, but they moved as militant women. And if you're not a militant woman, you don't belong in the revolution. But they acted out of their long experience with bad faith of white men. Yet, and this is important, if they acted wrongly with regard to the Black Panther Party, then let us forgive and understand one another so that we may have a trusting comradeship in a common struggle.
Now, can I have 4 minutes?
Okay, I'll try. I'll try 4 minutes. I wanted to talk about the rise of the women's liberation movement, and we'll see if we can beat the light. The radical women's liberation movement was created by an international revolutionary movement and is part of it. It was created by the myth of freedom, which was destroyed by the reality of oppression. From the beginning, women fought beside the men in the struggle. She gave strongly and courageously to the cause of everyone's freedom. But very often in the past, it was for everyone else's freedom and never her own. Yet we all know that missionaries make untrustworthy revolutionaries. So it was of the greatest significance that women, and most particularly white women, began to wake up, began to see that they were oppressed. We are oppressed, the women cried, full of early rage at this astounding discovery. We are not free. We are exploited, we are used and told to be happy in our enslavement, in our inferiority, our so-called biological inferiority, which has to some of our ears a very familiar ring. And over all of us stands the white man. Racism so long blinded women, so long hid from the white woman the truth of her oppression. The white man hid from the white woman her great strength, her kinship, sisterhood with all others like her, with all the oppressed peoples of the world. The white man taught his women to be passive, to be sexy, to be stupid, to be lonely, to be reactionary, to be the bastion of racism and fascism. In fact, what Marx called a whore, stood in the place of a living, vibrant, and precious human being, full of rage and love, strength and tenderness. Humanity will not be denied in revolutionary times, and these are revolutionary times. The humanity and dignity, the freedom of women cannot be denied and will not be denied, for women no longer ask. Now women are ready to struggle for their freedom.
One minute. Okay.
Half. The path of women will move and must move then from that of the missionary to the revolutionary. Women must be made to disbelieve in their own inferiority and the acceptance of that, if they are ever to be set free, and if in their just rage they are to become the new army, the new soldiers in the common struggle to destroy what is a corrupt and evil society and to construct what will be a just and free society. That is, they will be soldiers in their own right and against their own oppression. In this way, we may construct the steel bands of revolutionary comradeship. In this way, engage the battle, for people fight best when they fight for their own freedom. Together, as equal comrades, recognizing the solidarity of all oppressed people, we shall withstand repression, we shall endure, and we shall win. Each seeming failure only ensures the strengthening of our people and the broadening of the struggle. Hardly an oppressed group today, including women, is without the dream of freedom or without the determination to struggle for it. As a very great woman, assassinated by the German government as a dangerous revolutionary, Rosa Luxemburg, once said, "The history of revolutionary struggle is a history of failure, but you only need to win once, and we shall." All power to the people!
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. You've been listening to an excerpt of a 3-day Black Panther Party conference held in 1969. This particular part of it was called Women Speak Out Against Fascism. If you'd like to access the other parts of this conference, you can visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. This program is written and produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer with special help from Jolene Beiser for research. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and your host, Brian DeShazer. From the Vault is presented as part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, which is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, the American Archive, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, past grants from the Grammy Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and partnerships with UC Berkeley's Moffitt Library and from Pacifica Station members. Our theme music is by Kevin Drum Holiday. Thanks for listening and keeping our women's history alive.
Welcome back, and that was excerpts from the United Front Against Fascism conference of July 1969, a panel on women and the struggle against fascism. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment for the Pan-African Journal, this special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March the 29th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll be right back.
Tell me that the sun belongs to you and should surround you. If when I turn to look, I see they've snatched the sun from all around you. Why you hardly seem to want what's yours, you hardly seem to care. If you love the sun where you come from, then you had better dare to seize the time. The time is now, oh seize the time, and you know how. You tell me that the soul is real and your soul must survive. Yet I see they taking liberty with your souls and your lives. Don't tell me that you lack concern for all that you must be, 'cause I know you must not be turned, and I know that you can see. You worry about liberty because you've been denied. Well, I think that you're mistaken, or then you must have lied. 'Cause you do not act like those who care. You've never even fought for the liberty that you claim to lack, or have you never fought to seize the time? The time is now, oh seize the time, and you know how.
Welcome back. And that was Elaine Brown doing the title track from the 1969 album entitled Seize the Time. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March the 29th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Our concluding segment is excerpts from a United Nations special rapporteur on Palestine report, which confirms the legal allegations that were made by the Republic of South Africa back in December, and the January, of course, ruling by the International Court of Justice that the charges of genocide were plausible against the State of Israel. Let's listen to this report.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this press conference at the Palais des Nations in Geneva, which is currently hosting the 55th regular session of the United Nations Human Rights Council. We are very pleased to have with us Ms. Francesca Albanese, who's the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territories occupied since 1967. The United Nations Human Rights Council appointed Francesca Albanese as the holder of this mandate on April 1st, 2022. Since the start of her mandate, Ms. Albanese has presented four reports, two to the UN General Assembly and two others to the UN Human Rights Council. She presented her latest report yesterday to the Human Rights Council and participated in an interactive dialogue with UN member states and non-governmental organizations. The special rapporteur will first make opening remarks, and before taking your questions, Ms. Albanese, vous avez la parole.
Merci. Bonjour à toutes et tous. After 5 months of monitoring and analyzing Israel's onslaught on Gaza, my report finds that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the threshold indicating that Israel is committing the crime of genocide against the Palestinians as a group in Gaza has been met. Specifically, Israel has committed three acts of genocide with a requisite intent, killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, and deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. The flagrant and systematic slaughter of Palestinian civilians, the deployment of unlawful weaponry, the utter obliteration of vital civilian infrastructure, including the deliberate targeting of all Gaza's hospitals and the man-made starvation of the Palestinian people, transcend the realm of war crimes and crimes against humanity that had been seen in the occupied Palestinian territory before. The monstrosity unfolding is accompanied by a pervasive anti-Palestinian narrative and dehumanization emanating from the uppermost tiers of Israeli society, including high-ranking officials with command authority and frequently reflected in soldiers' actions on the ground. This reflects the intent, a dolus specialis, to destroy in whole or in part, which is what distinguishes genocide from other atrocity crimes. In the case of Gaza, there exists a chilling clarity of this purpose, the systematic eradication of an entire people, or at least a significant part thereof. One of the key findings is that Israel's executive and military leadership and soldiers have intentionally distorted, using Bello principles, subvertive their protection functions in an attempt to legitimize genocidal violence against the Palestinian people. The only reasonable inference that can be drawn from the unveiling of this policy is an Israeli state policy of genocidal violence toward the Palestinian people in Gaza. I will now be happy to take your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Albanese. We'll first take questions from the room. Reuters, please.
Madam Special Rapporteur, thank you. Just wondering on a personal level for you, given how vocal you have been and how some of your statements might not please certain people, have you received any threats, any attempts at intimidation while working on this report? Thank you.
thank you for your concern. I mean, it's been a difficult time. I've always I've been attacked since the very beginning of my mandate. I don't say that it's been a pleasant journey, but I can tell you it's much more. I mean, most of the pain comes from where I have to observe and monitor and investigate day by day. Yeah, I do receive threats. Nothing that so far I have considered needing extra precautions. Pressure, yes, and it doesn't change what either my commitment or the results of my work, I think.
Yes, Moussa Assi, Al Mayadeen TV, please.
Merci beaucoup. Madame Albanese, vous avez évoqué des génocides depuis 1948 ou 1947, et cela a fait beaucoup d'écho du côté israélien. Comment vous pouvez nous expliquer donc votre point de vue concernant cette hypothèse, donc le massacre qui ont été commis en 1947 avant la création d'Israël, ou bien après, ou bien comment ça a déroulé cette hypothèse? Merci.
Je m'excuse, mais je n'ai pas vraiment compris la première partie de votre question. Quelle hypothèse?
Donc, dans votre rapport, vous avez parlé des actes des génocides depuis la création d'Israël.
Non, je n'ai pas fait ça.
Non.
Je suis désolée, je n'ai pas fait ça.
D'accord. Alors
D'autres l'ont fait, mais si vous avez bien lu mon rapport,
oui.
Je pense que ce n'est pas le cas, parce que je n'ai jamais évoqué ça. Je parlais d'une autre chose. Je dis que, et je l'ai bien mis dans le contexte de l'histoire, le génocide, ce n'est pas un acte, c'est un processus. Et l'histoire coloniale est pleine de idéologies et pratiques génocidaires. Parce qu'il vise à l'élimination des peuples indigènes, des peuples autochtones. La Palestine a expérimenté, le peuple palestinien en Palestine a expérimenté ces pratiques dès le début. Je n'ai pas conclu que c'est du génocide dès le début, mais clairement, c'est des pratiques éliminatoires. Parce que ce que les Palestiniens sont en train d'expérimenter aujourd'hui, c'est nouveau et choquant pour ceux qui ne connaissent pas l'histoire de la Palestine, mais la destruction des villages, le dépeuplement forcé, être chassé, désintégré en tant que peuple, c'est quelque chose qui est la Nakba. La Nakba, c'est ce que les Palestiniens ont vécu depuis le 1947, et encore, le 1967, personne n'en parle, mais destruction des villages, dépeuplement forcé, ce qu'ils ont vécu. C'est pour ça que je dis, c'est pas tout à fait nouveau, mais non, on a atteint un niveau qu'on peut plus ignorer. On a un crime qui est là, une définition légale. Il faut simplement considérer ce qui se passe aujourd'hui. Et peut-être que d'autres vont faire l'analyse de si c'était déjà génocide de 1947. Ce n'est pas mon cas, mais je suis très convaincue de ce que j'écris dans le rapport pour maintenant.
Before we take questions from journalists online, Jan Dirk Eberman, Tiger Spiegel.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to ask you on the intent of the Israeli government or Israeli militaries to commit genocide. You are saying that there is intent, and you're quoting the president of Israel, the prime minister, the defense minister, and some top militaries. But these are only quotes given in speeches or in other circumstances. I would like to ask you, do you have a written document by the government with a clear intent to commit genocide?
Do you think that in Rwanda and in Bosnia-Herzegovina any government officials wrote a document saying, I want to commit genocide? Have you seen anything like that? I'll answer this for you. No, it doesn't work like that. There is, those statements are just the tip of the iceberg, because I have a word limit in my report. It is quite strict. Otherwise, we could write an encyclopedia with what has been said and done. And I said it, and I mean it. If the International Criminal Court is serious about investigating what Israel has done in Gaza, as of the 7th of October, only as of the 7th of October, it will be busy for decades. Looking at the previous genocides and jurisprudence that has been developed on those cases, it's clear that the intent can be direct in statements, public statements, declarations, having people with command authority, or having the prime minister, and having the president of the state issuing statements. They are so dehumanizing, evoking violence. Not once, not twice, continuously for months. It's supported by jurisprudence in other cases, that this is genocidal incitement. And look what, it's been reflected, it has reverberated across the conduct of troops on the ground. They've used the same words, Amalek. Amalek is a program in itself. And then, as you say, are there documents? If you read my report, you will see that I've quoted official documents, legal analysis, that the legal justification that Israel uses, there are two, one version and then an updated version with the key legal findings. And it's exactly what I said, it's humanitarian camouflage, because they justify what they're doing using IHL categories, evacuations and human shields. Everyone is a human shield. Everyone is a human shield. Women, children, anything that is between the troops and whatever is their objective. And by the way, the overall objective, eradicating Hamas, destroying Hamas, which is, it's not even a real military objective. Because one thing is to neutralize, destroy the military capacity of an organization. Another thing is to target also the civilian component, and this is what has been done. Every Hamas affiliate has been considered targetable, killable, and so their family members. This explains the 30,000 people who have been killed, plus, I mean, this is a conservative figure I'm referring to.
Nina Larson, AFP.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. Over here. I was wondering if you could say something about the countries that are providing weapons and other support to Israel. You've called for an arms embargo and sanctions, but what responsibility did those countries carry for providing the weapons up until now? And now that you've called for this and you're saying that this is a fairly clear requirement, what is their responsibility if they continue? If you could say something about that. Thank you.
Yes, I formulated that recommendation because this is a clear emanation of the Genocide Convention. When there is a risk of genocide, there are obligations that are immediately have to be followed. So there are different things, but suspending arms transfers, suspending weapons transfer is necessary in order to reduce the level of hostilities and violence against civilians. After the 26th of January's ICJ interim ruling, there was no doubt whatsoever that was the obligation pending on all states, and this has not been acted upon. So I didn't formulate, of course we know who's the main political and also economic supporter of Israel. So of course the eye and the mind immediately goes to the United States, but there are other states. And I intend to look further into these, so probably my next report will be on this topic, on the issue of responsibility.
We'll go to journalists who are participating online, starting with Antonio Brotto, FA.
I just wanted to follow up. I just wanted to check. Would you say that they could be considered complicit in the genocide that you've seen?
This is not something that I can conclude right now, but the risk is there. And there are already legal proceedings that have been started in the United States, for example, by the Center for Constitutional Rights. So, but I'm not in a position to conclude that as well.
Okay, we'll move to journalists who are attending this press conference online, starting with Antonio Brotto, Spanish news agency, please.
Thank you very much. I would like to ask if you think that your conclusions should accelerate the verdict of International Court of Justice regarding genocide in Gaza. Some say that it could take years for them to make a decision, but do you think it could be faster? Thank you.
I do not know if this will accelerate the proceedings of the court. I imagine that my report brings to the fore an important piece of analysis, which is what I called humanitarian camouflage. Because the tendency is to look at what Israel has done as isolated war crimes. And this is why I say, well, if we take a step back and look at the full picture, and for once we try not to miss the forest for the trees, we get it. Also because it's been said, the intent is so ostentatious. I mean, they're already planning how to rebuild Gaza for the settlers. It's shocking. And so probably that will provide further analytical elements. But my objective as a special rapporteur is not necessarily to influence the court, is to make sure the member states comply with international law, because it's not an act of charity. It's an international obligation they have. And a society which accepts to depart from international law, it's a society, and I talk about the international community, which accepts to face barbarity, because this is when we leave the use of force unchecked rule our international order.
A second question online from Yuri Aprelev, RIA Novosti, Russian news agency.
Oui, bonjour et merci pour ce briefing. Je vais vous poser la question en français, si vous n'êtes pas contre. Dans vos courtes remarques préliminaires, vous avez dit que trois faits laissaient penser qu'un génocide était commis à Gaza. Le premier que vous avez évoqué, c'est la mort massive de civils. Le deuxième que vous avez évoqué, c'est les conditions inhumaines qui sont imposées à la population palestinienne. Et je n'ai pas le troisième raison pour laquelle je vous pose la question. Et je voulais aussi savoir si ces conditions s'appliquent uniquement à Gaza ou si elles concernent aussi la Cisjordanie. Merci.
It's on. Yeah. Et oui, alors, il y a trois actes que j'ai cités dans le rapport. C'est infliger de la souffrance physique et mentale à la population, à un membre du groupe, et la création de conditions qui rendraient la vie impossible aux membres du groupe. Et de nouveau, tout l'ensemble, dans la préparation du rapport, c'était difficile pour moi de vraiment distinguer et d'analyser séparément les différents éléments, parce qu'ils sont tellement l'un dans l'autre, c'est-à-dire priver la population d'hôpitaux, d'anesthétiques. Et c'est soit causé de la douleur aux enfants et aux autres adultes qui ont été amputés sans anesthésie.
voyez, c'est une chose incroyable. Mais à la fois, c'est aussi créer les conditions à la population pour ne pas pouvoir vivre. On ne sait pas encore combien de gens sont morts parce qu'il n'y avait pas des hôpitaux et il n'y avait pas la possibilité de se soigner normalement. C'est pour ça que c'est finalement ça seront les tribunaux qui de toutes les façons, vont confirmer tout ce qui s'est passé dans le détail, mais ça, c'était, disons, ma conclusion.
Une troisième question en ligne, Nick Cummings Bruce, The New York Times, before we go back to the room.
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for taking the question. Your report includes a recommendation for deploying an international protective presence. I wondered if you could just dig into that, explain what it is you've got in mind, and say whether or not you've engaged and had any discussions with states on that particular issue, where the thinking is going on that. And a second question, just following up on my colleagues, you say it's too soon for you to determine whether states providing arms are complicit in commission of war crimes or potentially genocide. Could you just explain a little bit what the reasoning there is? I mean, on one hand, we've got states that are providing weapons that are being used directly in the hostilities that you say may amount to acts of genocide. So what's holding you back from identifying complicity? Thank you.
What holds me back from referring to complicity is that I've not investigated this. I mean, I don't throw claims out there on things, on matters that I've not investigated, as simple as that. Although, I say, it's under our watch. But if it's so much under our watch, why are the responsible actors to not intervene? So I will, as I said, I will investigate this, and unless there are no other urgent priorities. And I apologize to the journalist before, because he asked me another piece of question, and I hope he won't mind me answering in English, but no, I've not looked at whether genocide, the crime of genocide, extends to the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But again, the problem is that here there is genocide is committed against a group in whole or in part, and here the attack is against the Palestinians as a people, where they are still a fracture of the international orders that hits the people as such, so not the people of Gaza, the Palestinian people in Gaza. I must apologize, but I'm also extremely sick today, and it's a bit painful to be here, so I apologize, but I will ask you to repeat the first part of the question, because I missed it.
Yeah, sure. It was the reference in your report to the deployment of an international protective presence. What did you have in mind, and have you had any discussion with people? What's the thinking around that? Thank you.
Yes, of course. Those who have followed my work since I became a special rapporteur know that I've been recommending the establishment of a protective presence for a long time now. And I will tell you what I mean, but let me tell you before that anyone I've engaged with, states and UN alike, roll their eyes when I say that, to say Israel will never accept it. And at what point will we be able to draw a line and say, enough, you cannot decide everything without consequences?
Welcome back. And that was the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Palestine, Francisca Albanese, speaking about a recently released report saying that genocide is being committed against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-Africa, the special worldwide radio broadcast for Friday, March 29th, 2024, we've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. And if you'd like to have access to this program, go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network, That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of many of the issues that were discussed in today's program, go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the legendary Vi Reed. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
If I should lose you, the stars would fall from the sky. If I should lose you, the leaves would wither and die. The birds in Maytime would sing a mournful refrain, and I would wander round, hating the sound of a rain. With you beside me, the rose would bloom in the snow. With you beside me, no winds of winter would blow. I gave you my love, and I was living a dream, and living would seem in vain. If I ever lost you, are jumping and the cotton is a high. Oh, your daddy's rich and your ma is good looking. So hush, little baby, don't you cry. One of these mornings you're gonna rise up singing. Then you'll spread your wings and you'll take to the sky. But till that morning, ain't nothing can harm you. With daddy and mommy standing by. Thank you.
Together on the family tree, brothers and sisters here on earth. And now before it's too late, you better know what it's worth. And it's getting pretty late right now.